From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall, and this is Choral Arts Classics. Tonight, we begin our 13th season of Choral Arts Classics with a conversation about three giants of the Western musical canon, Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Ray Sprenkel, the composer and musicologist who is a great friend of this show and a well-known lecturer on all things musical. We'll talk about these three iconic figures, and we'll explore what it is about their music that has made it last so long in the hearts of listeners, really across the centuries. We'll be listening to excerpts from live performances by the Baltimore Choral Arts Society to a rarely performed mini cantata by Beethoven. We'll hear a short gem by Mozart that was one of the last pieces he composed before his death, and another rarity, a dazzling solo cantata by Sebastian Bach that shows that Bach's prowess as a composer of solo music is easily on par with his genius for writing for chorus. Hello again, and thanks for joining us for Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and the co-host of Maryland Morning here on 88.1 WYPR. Glad you could be with us tonight, as we have done for the past 12 years. On the last Tuesday night of the month, from September through April, we get together and we listen to and talk about great choral and vocal music, and we sample recordings and live performances of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and our special guests. I appreciate your tuning in and joining us tonight. It's my pleasure now to welcome back to the program Ray Sprenkel. He served on the faculty of the Peabody Conservatory of Music for many years, and if you're a music lover, chances are very good that you've heard him present lectures about music for organizations like the Shriver Hall Concert Series and many others. Back in the day, he hosted a music program on WIPR's predecessor, WJHU Radio. Ray Sprenkel, always good to see you. How you
doing? Nice to be here, Tom.
Welcome back to the show. So we have these three colossus. Yeah. Figures, you know, colossal figures, Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart, not in any particular order. But what do you think? Do they actually share common traits that they're all great? We all sort of, you know, acknowledge that. But are there things in common that they have that make them great?
Yeah, there are. There's no doubt about that. But I do want to speak to their sort of canonic place first. There was an interesting article. I'm sure some people listening will know about it. Tomasini, the principal music critic of the New York Times. I think it was the winter of 2010.
Yeah.
Anthony, 2010, 2011. He wrote a series of articles on the top 10 classical composers. And he said from the very beginning, the whole notion is preposterous. Admitting that, who are the top 10? And his first three composers were Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
He said Bach by far, number one. And he said it's a toss-up between Beethoven and Mozart for number two. So on some days of the week, it's Beethoven, Mozart. On other days of the week, it's Mozart, Beethoven.
And Bach perhaps has that top spot because he's not only so significant for listeners, he's really fundamental for every musician. Players and singers,
from every point
you gotta know Bach.
From every point of view, there's not a point of view that I can think of where Bach is not, you're right, the very center of the repertoire, so to speak, the center of the tradition, such as it is. Really, in our time, Tom, Bach's music has transcended Western civilization. I mean, what we just said applies for the Pacific Rim. In countries like Japan and Korea, Taiwan, China, who are sending their people to study in a lot of Western conservatories, and they play Bach well, and they seem to love Bach as we do. So he has touched that nerve somewhere. It's a good time for Bach, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But I remember as a kid, it was Handel.
Yeah.
It was Handel.
Yeah. Tastes do change.
Yeah.
I wonder if Tomasini's article had come out in the 1960s, Bach would have been even in the top 10
for some
people.
That there's a tremendous Handel revival in New York. So who's to know where it's going to be in 10 years?
Yeah.
But right now it's Bach.
And, of course, each of the three of them enjoyed differing amounts of fame while they were alive.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Bach, of the three of them, probably enjoyed the least amount of
I think that's true.
Fame.
Yeah.
Handel, in the middle of the 18th century, was a considerably
far and away famous
figure. Yes, he was wealthier. He was more well-known. Yeah. Bach was fairly parochial, working in this little church in Leipzig, Germany. Mozart, Beethoven, you know, they had their good days. They had their bad days. But Beethoven, I guess, really the only one of the three who was able to sort of, at least at some point, make all of his living, his money, as a commissioned composer.
Yeah, he did. And he was toward the end of his life, and the piece of music you're doing by him on this program, I think, comes from 1814, 1815. I mean, he was really famous.
Yeah.
The Congress of Vienna was about to meet, and one of the attractions of Vienna was Beethoven for those politicians. And I don't think you can say that about Mozart. You do get the sense that after Mozart died, that there was regret in the city of Vienna that he had not been treated better. Somehow there was an acknowledgement that, oh dear, which does tell you something about Mozart. As far as I know, when Bach died, he just died.
Yeah, and nobody commented on it one way or the other.
To my knowledge, no doubt somebody will find something in the future. But right now,
what about matters of personal temperament? Were they similar personalities? Were they vastly different?
Well, from what I know about, we don't know about Bach. What we know about Bach comes from his letters and little, they don't tell us hardly anything about the man. We know a little bit more about Bach than we do about Shakespeare. And let's admit it, we don't even know where Shakespeare came from. Beethoven, we know a lot about. And frankly, Tom, I think most people listening would not like Beethoven if they met him in person. Just an awful human being. Mozart, you know, there's that wonderful portrait of Mozart in that film, Amadeus, which
by now is quite old.
It is.
Early 90s, if I recall.
But anybody who's seen that film, I think, is going to think of Mozart forever from that point of view. And, of course, that's not Mozart. That's the fictional imagining of him. So I don't know.
Touches of truth.
Yes, all based on letters, mm-hmm. as far as I know. And mm-hmm. we do have a lot of letters by Mozart, and he strikes you as a real flesh and blood human being. You could live next door to Mozart.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to listen to music by all three of these giants, and we're going to start now with a small piece by Beethoven, the Elegiac Song, the Elegische Gesang, a piece that you hardly ever hear, as you mentioned, composed around 1814, but not actually published until the year before his death in 1826. And it is an elegy to the wife of a patron of Beethoven's, a young woman who died at the age of 24. So the text is, "Gently as you lived, have you died, too holy for sorrow. Let no eye shed tears for the spirit's heavenly homecoming." That's the English translation. Of course, we'll sing it in German, the German language being the original language that Beethoven set. The Elegiac Song of Beethoven, music of Beethoven here on Choral Arts Classics. music by Beethoven here on Choral Arts Classics, his rarely heard motet for chorus and orchestra, The Elegiac Song. The Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra performed it in a concert at Krausau Auditorium on the campus of Goucher College last October. You're listening to Choral Arts Classics here on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted the performance we just heard, and I'm joined tonight in the studio by my good buddy Ray Sprenkle. That's a beautiful...
It is a beautiful piece.
...reflection.
You know, Tom, I got to be honest with you. I never even heard of it until you mentioned it. I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah. Originally composed for string quartet and four solo
singers,
voices.
Yeah, very intimate work. You get the impression from that he may have designed it to be performed at somebody's house.
Yeah,
I wonder.
The setting is by a guy named Ignaz Castelli.
Yeah, he's a local poet.
And it was dedicated to a patron of his, as we said, on the death of his wife. So it probably was performed at a little, you know, maybe a memorial gathering in the house.
If it was performed.
Yeah.
Who knows? Beethoven had a habit of responding to requests for his music. He would do it eventually, but a lot of times he was so late with the piece of music that the event for which it was written had already occurred.
Yeah, yeah.
And so who knows?
But it is, it's like it's this little gem.
Yeah, yet that minute or so of strings, quietly done. The whole piece is quiet except for one outburst. And then the choir comes in. There's a little a cappella section. First time I heard it, and I've heard it several times since you brought it up. And I was reminded of some stretches of the Missa Solemnis, the Sanctus, just spiritually. And then if you know the late string quartets, there are passages there that this piece would strike you as coming from the same kind of ground. But this is second period Beethoven. This is 1814. This is not late period Beethoven.
And when people talk about that, what do they mean? Not all composers have an early, middle, and late period, but Beethoven does. People really do divide his music into three very clear
parts. I know you're going to do Mozart next.
Yeah.
We talk about the three style periods of Beethoven so often that it's almost as if he's the only composer who ever had style periods,
right?
Until Stravinsky or something. Whereas was you listen to Mozart when he was in Salzburg and you listen to Mozart when he was in Vienna, it's two different composers.
Right. Salzburg is very young. Points an actual kid.
Yes.
I mean, literally a kid. His first symphony
and
was
it's
written
the
at
same
the age
thing
of
nine. With Bach. Young Bach is different than old Bach. Mm-hmm. But somehow Beethoven had style periods. And there's the first period where he supposedly imitated Haydn and Mozart, among others, in the second period where he hits his stride, the so-called heroic monumental period. And it's that period that he writes all this music that we actually play. And then the late period where you get the impression that Beethoven is writing music for himself rather than a public. And that's why this elegiac song comes across as late period, I think. It's such a quiet piece of music. You're not quite sure for whom he wrote it. It doesn't strike you as a big concert hall piece.
No.
Bravo for scoring it, for programming
it. Yeah, no, we had a good time. We, of course, never had done it before, but I'd always wanted to do it because I thought it was a nice way to start this thing. And we move from that to another very gem-like miniature.
Maybe the definition of gem.
Yeah, which is a much more famous piece. Yeah. It's a piece that a lot of people know. It's called the Ave Verum Corpus of Mozart. This is a late piece in Mozart's life. His last work was the Magic Flute, and then, of course, the Requiem, which he was writing at the time of his death. And he wrote this sort of in that same period, right before he passed away in 1791. This is early in the year, and he passed away, later. This is written, again, for another friend of both Mozart's and Haydn's, a guy named Anton Stoll, who had a little church choir in a small town outside of Vienna.
I'm sure that affected how the piece was.
Yeah, so he wasn't going to write it for big forces. So again, just like the Beethoven piece, it's scored for strings, just strings, and chorus. But this is really quite an extraordinary piece. And Mozart, at the end of his life, of course, he didn't know it was the end of his life. He was in his mid-30s. He had no reason to believe it was the end of his life at
right.
this point.
Right, he didn't know. That's
but,
true.
But, what do you think makes this piece so extraordinary?
Well, there's almost nothing quite like it, although the Requiem, which comes after, I believe, almost immediately afterwards, I think the Requiem should be perceived through this piece. And I didn't know this, but reading Landon, whose book, Mozart's Last Year, I think was written as a rebound from that movie, Amadeus,
mm-hmm.
Because publishers saw, hey, let's talk about Mozart. there's an audience for it. And Landon points out that Mozart, in his final months, was angling to get the position of choir master at St. Stephen's, which I did not know.
That's the Stephen's, the big cathedral
in Vienna.
Vienna.
I never knew that. And to that end, he wrote some music. And although the Ave Verum Corpus is always perceived as something that was written for this little choir in Baden, I think. It's exemplary of the new church music style that Mozart was fooling around with, which is a kind of plaintive, easily understood. You perceive the piece and its complexities the first time you hear it. You don't need to hear the piece five times. It makes its case and gets out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, the emperor, Joseph, had called for a new kind of church music. Get rid of all the orchestral mass settings. Get rid of all the figuration and the ostentation. Write a simple, direct music, and voila, here mm-hmm. it is.
And so many times, music for the church is dictated either by the aristocracy or
right.
the church hierarchy. Mozart had a famous archbishop for whom he and his father worked, the Archbishop of Salzburg, when he was a young kid and a young man, who made a dictate that the church services, the masses, were too long.
Yeah.
They had to get... He wanted to shorten the mass. Usually the clergy is all for extending the services. This guy said, nope, we've been spending much too much time in church. We really must cut this time down. So he ordered Mozart to, you know, cut back on the amount of music he was writing for the masses. It's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's give Mozart's Ave Verum Corpus a listen. This is, again, we'll sing this in Latin, of course, the original language, but the text is, "Hail the true body, born of the Virgin Mary, you who truly suffered and were sacrificed on the cross for the sake of man, from whose pierced flank flowed a water and blood, be a foretaste for us in the trial of death." A beautiful setting of Ave Verum Corpus, music of Mozart here on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you.
music of Amadeus Mozart, his beautiful and sublime setting of Ave Verum Corpus. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to the season opening edition of Choral Arts Classics here on WIPR. I conducted the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra at Krausauer Auditorium last October. In this performance, my guest tonight is the musicologist and raconteur Ray Sprenkel. It really is quite a stunning piece, that work. Every time I hear it, and I've conducted it a bazillion times, it's kind of like the Hallelujah Chorus. It really, literally never gets less powerful.
Yeah, I was thinking if you were going to make a list of the 25 big classical works, it's a small work to be sure, but it might make the top 25.
Yeah. And it's an interesting, interesting conducting challenge in a way, because there's only one marking in the score, and it simply says sotto voce, half voice. And I take that quite literally. So as you heard, we had the chorus making no crescendos, no expressive, you know, swells of dynamics, just the entire thing sotto voce. It's not, I guess, not usually done that way. It's just, you know, it's a choice that one person can make that another person might not want to make. But of course, Beethoven's music, a little bit, in a sense, easier to interpret, in that Beethoven's one of the first people who started writing in a lot of what his true intentions were when it came to things like dynamics and articulation. Do you play things smoothly? Do you play things, you know, with accents, loud, soft, etc. These two composers, though, they couldn't be more different in their compositional temperament. Mozart, it seemed to just flow out of him like water.
Yeah,
Beethoven, not so much.
Well, I think they're both incomprehensible, to be frank, how a human being can do what they did. But I was thinking, we were talking, Tom, at the beginning of the program about what is it that makes their music stand out, stand apart? Why are they top figures in our lexicon? And I don't know. You know, in Mozart's time, there were a lot of composers, you get the impression that they wrote music the way, and I don't mean to insult another profession, goodness, but the way a carpenter puts a chair together. These are the notes, and you put them together this way, and you get a pleasing result, and let's all go home and have a good whatever.
Yeah, because there were rules. You learned to be a composer the way you learned to, you know, any other guild.
This is how it was done, precisely.
You learned how, you know, a fugue was, you know, set up this way, and a sonata was set up this way, and there were rules to the craft.
And you do get the impression that these three figures, including Bach, all understood music poetically. I mean, they were masters of the language, but they were so fluent in moving notes around that they could treat it like it was poetry. And I think I think in the German-speaking lands, I know in Beethoven's time, the German-speaking lands, the poet was at the top of the pyramid in terms of
the artists.
Of the artist. Mm-hmm. The poet is at the top of the ladder. The musician is at the bottom of the ladder. And Beethoven, for that reason, preferred to be called a poet of tones. He disliked being called a composer. And I think he thought of composers as somebody who just put notes together to please other people, whereas that's clearly not how Beethoven thought of himself. I don't think Mozart did in the end, the last 5 years of his life or so. I think Mozart was striking. And, you know, had he lived longer, goodness knows what would have happened.
Sure, of course. Now, an awful lot was happening in Vienna. You've got Haydn and Mozart there at the end of the 1700s. Mozart dies before either Haydn or Beethoven.
That's
he
right.
dies in 1791. Haydn stops composing about 11 years later. And at this point, 1791, he had not yet composed his really big oratorios.
That's
right. The Creation and the Seasons. Beethoven lives until 1827. So, you know, it's, 30-something years, 40 years almost, after Mozart's death. What had changed in the music business? What had changed in the musical life of Vienna and the world between the time of Mozart's death in the early 1790s and Beethoven's death at the end of the 1820s?
Well, I think a Hopkins professor would say that the big change was the Enlightenment was coming to an end, and it gives way to the Napoleonic Age, and then Romanticism, which has very little to do with the Enlightenment, that's for sure. And that change doesn't occur Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Right. It's over a period of time.
It's over a period of time. As it's occurring, you're not even aware that it's occurring. You just wake up 10 years later and you say, oh, my goodness, things are different. But you can really hear that in Mozart's music, of all people. You can actually hear it in Beethoven's music if you take early Beethoven and then jump 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's quite astonishing. And these were people with very sensitive antenna, and they wanted their music to be appreciated by other human beings. So you could, in a way, say other human beings were responsible for this, in part, at any rate.
Well, speaking of appreciation, we're going to move now to the music of Sebastian Bach. And if ever there were a great genius who was unappreciated in his lifetime, perhaps Bach is the poster child for that person. Yeah. We're going to listen to the first part of a cantata that he wrote for a solo voice, a solo soprano. It's Cantata 51. It's called Jauchzet Gott in allen Landen, or Shout for Joy to God in Every Land. Most of his cantatas that he wrote for the church, of course, for chorus, soloists and small orchestra, but this one just for solo soprano and for solo trumpet. We've got two terrific artists joining us for this, soprano Nola Richardson and the trumpet virtuoso, the principal trumpet player of the Baltimore Symphony, Andrew Balio, joined by the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. We're going to hear the first part of this, first the aria, Jauchzet Gott in allen Landen, and then a recitative and another aria called Höchste Mach Deine Güte. So shout for joy to God in every land, followed by a recitative talking about praying at the temple where God's honor dwells, and then Höchste Mach Deine Güte, Most High God, make your goodness new every morning from now on. Music of Bach here on Choral Arts Classics. Oh,
Thank you.
on 88.1 WYPR. It's Choral Arts Classics, music by J.S. Bach from his joyous and brilliant Cantata 51 for solo, soprano, and orchestra. We've heard soprano Nola Richardson and trumpet soloist Andrew Balio with the Choral Arts Orchestra in a live performance recorded at Krausar Auditorium in October of last year. By the way, this program note, the full chorus and orchestra will be back at Krausar Auditorium on Sunday afternoon, November 1st, when we'll begin our 50th anniversary season performing two settings of the Catholic Requiem Mass by two great French masters, Gabriel Fauré and Maurice Durufle. The Fauré and Durufle Requiems, huge favorites of music lovers around the world, and we're looking forward to sharing them with you. Hope you can join us Sunday, the 1st of November at Goucher College. My friend, the composer and musicologist Ray Sprenkel, joins me in the studio to talk tonight about Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. This cantata Bach composed for the solo soprano, very interesting piece because almost none of the other cantatas are for a solo voice. What do you think happened in this case?
I don't know. I often wondered if he was looking elsewhere for employment, to be frank, because we know that Bach did that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he had five different jobs as he, you know, his career progressed, but this last one lasted for 20-something years.
And he was playing with a new style or demonstrating that he could write in a new style, because there's nothing like it in his, you're right, Tom, there's nothing like it in the other cantatas that I'm aware of.
It's like Bach's mini opera.
Right. Yeah. What I've been able to find out about the cantata is that it's kind of infill, which is to say one author suggests that he needed a cantata for the 15th Sunday after Trinity, and what a bore. Mm-hmm. So he plugs this in, and he attempted various cycles of cantatas, and some people say three, others say five, others say seven, I don't know. Some Sundays are going to naturally call forth more music than others.
Yeah, and of course, we should remind folks that was his job.
That was his job.
The Kapellmeister at two churches, the Thomaskirche and the Nikolaikirche,
right.
The St. Thomas and the St. Nicholas Church in Leipzig, Germany. His job, not like, you know, the choir conductors today, and you were a church musician for many years, was I. Our job is to perform music every Sunday. His job was not only to perform it, but to compose it.
That's right.
It's mind-boggling.
And he was in cahoots with the clergy. They would work on the text beforehand.
So when you say 15th Sunday after Trinity, in fact, there
was a specific
liturgical purpose for the music he was writing for that Sunday or any Sunday, and he coordinated with the clergy to make sure that the message of his music was consonant with the message that the clergy was preaching.
That's right, and I'm sure there are people listening, Tom, who know the meaning of the 15th Sunday after Trinity.
I am not one of them.
But they will agree with me, I think, when one says it's not a big Sunday. Mm-hmm. Musically, it doesn't call forth any text that I'm aware of, that's why the text here just says ordinary time. He says it's a little comment on
in ordinary time,
so you could plug it in anywhere,
any time. Yeah, and that's not bad to have a sort of evergreen cantata that you can pull off the shelf anytime. But
he's got to have a good trumpet player and a good treble to cut this thing.
And of course, the singer in Bach's time would have been a little boy, would not have been a woman.
Right,
women were
Makes
not allowed
wonder.
In the choir. But you can you imagine a little boy singing this? Which is why people have said, you know, I can't imagine a little boy singing.
No, I can't
either. It's just too hard. So he wrote it for somebody, somewhere, for some reason that none of us have been able to quite figure out now.
Right, and that's just because Bach is too far back. Now, somebody, Tom, is going to piece together enough little tiny tidbits, detective work. And 20 years from now, somebody else will take all these new factoids and then voila,
and figure
we'll
out
know.
What Bach is doing in 1730 in Leipzig,
in the
Germany.
15th day after,
Sunday,
15th after Sunday
after Trinity. But his cantatas were composed for cycles of the church year. So, you know, there's 52 Sundays in a year, generally speaking.
I think it's 67 feast days. I've read that number.
And he writes, you know, these cantatas. Now, there are folks who think that he did write, in fact, five complete sets.
Right.
Two of which have been completely lost.
They don't exist.
Somebody threw him away.
It is mind-boggling. Now, Mozart, just to tie him back in, apparently makes a visit and sees Bach in Leipzig and sees handwritten stuff and hears one of the motets being performed.
This is long after Bach, of course, had passed away.
And Mozart is said to have paused and said, "Now there's a master," or something to that effect.
Well, he had a good ear for talent, a good ear for a lot of things.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Ray Sprenkel, it's been fun talking to you. We're
going
to finish up by listening to the rest of this Bach cantata, but thanks for coming by, and we shall see you the next time.
Okay.
Ray Sprenkel from the Peabody Conservatory and a program annotator and lecturer all around town. So now we're going to listen to the final two movements of this terrific cantata 51. First, a chorale, Zeilob und Preis, and that'll feature the women of the Choral Arts full chorus, and then this incredible, exuberant Alleluia, which features soprano Nola Richardson and the trumpet soloist Andrew Balio. This is music from Cantata 51 by Sebastian Bach, right here on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you.
Music by J.S. Bach from his Cantata 51. Nola Richardson and Andrew Balio teamed up for this great final Alleluia. Before that, we heard the women of the Choral Arts Chorus and violinists Ken Goldstein and Leonid Briskin in the Chorale Sei Lob und Preis mit Ehrengott, which means may there be praise and glory and honor for God. I conducted the Choral Arts Orchestra in a live performance last season in October at Krausauer Auditorium up in Towson. On 88.1 WYPR, this is the first edition of the 13th season of Choral Arts Classics. We are very glad that you've been with us tonight. Let me tell you about a couple of cool events coming up. If you like to sing, we'd love to have you join us at our annual Community Sing on Friday night, October 9th at the Open Church on Route 40. Choral Arts is teaming up with our great friends Marco Merrick and the Community Choir of Baltimore and Pastor Brad Braxton of the Open Church for a night of coming together and singing together with a terrific conductor, Michelle Fallon. She's the conductor of the Children of the Gospel in Washington. We'll sing some great gospel music and some spirituals, and Michelle will have us harmonizing together in a matter of minutes. No experience is necessary. Bring your family, bring your friends. The Community Sing, it's part of the Free Fall Baltimore series in which many organizations in town present free events. So check out the details on our website, baltimorechoralarts.org. And on the first Sunday in November, November 1st, please join me and the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra for a performance of the Fauré Requiem and the Durafle Requiem. We'll be back at Krausauer Auditorium at 3 o'clock November 1st, and we hope you can also be there to enjoy this great pair of requiems by two wonderful French composers. We're calling this concert the French Connection, and to connect with details about the concert, again, please stop by baltimorechoralarts.org. Also, when you visit baltimorechoralarts.org, you can order Choral Arts CDs, including Christmas at America's First Cathedral and a recording with jazz legend Dave Brubeck. That'll do it for us tonight. Thanks to my guest, Ray Sprenkel. And next month here on Choral Arts Classics, my guest will be the internationally acclaimed soprano, Huna Yu. We'll talk about a wonderful cantata by Rafe Vaughan Williams, the poignant plea for peace that he composed as Europe drew closer to the Second World War. We'll talk to Huna about that cantata. It's called Dona Nobis Pacem, which we performed together last spring, and we'll discuss her career as one of the most sought-after sopranos on the music scene today. That's next month on Choral Arts Classics, Tuesday night, October 27th. You can hear Choral Arts Classics on the radio or on demand. Go to WYPR.org and catch up on shows you may have missed or shows you'd like to hear again. The producer of Choral Arts Classics is Luke Spicknall. Thanks to Luke for his help, and thanks to you for tuning in tonight. Thanks also to everybody who has pledged in our fall membership campaign. We appreciate the support for Choral Arts Classics and for all of the programs that you hear on 88.1. Hope you'll join Sheila Cass, Nathan Sterner, and me in the morning for Maryland Morning. I'm looking forward to a conversation with the author Daniel James Brown about his book, The Boys in the Boat. It's the One Maryland, One Book selection by the Maryland Humanities Council, and Mr. Brown will join me live in the studio tomorrow morning on Maryland Morning at 9 o'clock, right after Morning Edition. I'm Tom Hall for WYPR and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next month on Choral Arts Classics.